serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated this week to what some have referred to as the miraculous survival of the cruiser USS Houston 75 years ago this week in the Battle of Formosa. Torpedoed not once, but twice, it rolled beyond what was thought to be its sinking point, took on more water in relation to its displacement than any other ship that made it through the war, and somehow it did not sink. Jonas Hofer did not abandon ship after the first torpedo strike on October 14, 1944. He was ordered to abandon ship 2 days later, and he spent the next 14 to 16 hours in the water. I don't think you expected to hear him say that the first thing he did when connecting with other survivors in the water was to start singing hymns, but by now you figured out that faith was a big part of his story. Jonas had survived a near-fatal car crash as a teenager that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He had bars installed in his home and spent the next year swinging around the house like a monkey until, amazingly, his spine straightened out and the use of his legs returned. He even did some bodybuilding and became a championship pole vaulter. But at the age of 17, he enlisted in the Navy, and at age 18, he was steering the cruiser Houston when that first enemy torpedo crippled the ship. You heard him refer to the Bible study that he and another sailor led aboard the ship, but the story of how that originated and the obstacles they had to overcome is pretty unique, too.
I worked with the church, the chaplain, and I read a lot of books. So he had me help in the library. So we got crowded. There was about eight of us down in our little, where our bunks were at and that, and where we got together for prayer and that. And so Dyke asked, said, why don't you go ask the chaplain, you work in the library some, if we could use the ship's lounge. The ship's lounge had about 30 seats in there. And so I went and asked the chaplain, and the chaplain says, what makes you think we need Bible studies aboard ship? I said, well, everybody can gain with Bible studies then. Have you been to a seminary? I said, no, I've been to no seminary. Well, I forbid you to teach then. He says, without the seminary training, then how can you know the Bible? I said, I've studied it all my life and that there. He says, well, I forbid you. So 2 days later, I was steering the ship when the captain came up and says, Hofer, what's your problem with the chaplain? Why? He said, he put you on report, captain's report. That's like you have a small court and the captain judges you and that. The only thing I can figure out, I ask him to use the ship's lounge. And he says, what for? And I says, for these Bible studies and navigator material. And he says, I will forbid you. And I says, if I can't have Bible study, I'm in the wrong Navy. The captain says, well, when do you meet? I says, we meet on Monday nights. This was about a Wednesday or Thursday. And it says, have your next meeting in the ship's lounge. I'll be there. Wagner will be there, the other officer, and the chaplain. But do the meeting the way you always do them. Don't change anything. Just do them that way. Okay. Well, it was my turn to have the meeting. We took turns. I did more praying that week than ever done before. Went to the meeting. We had our meeting regular. Captain was there. Wagner was there, administrative officer, and the chaplain, and about 15 guys in that day. Because it was a little beer, and because of more room, they wanted to see what was going on. So afterwards, they saluted and left the net. The next day on the bulletin board in the ship was, from now on Monday night, there will be a navigators meeting in the ship's lounge. From 8 till 9, the smoking lamp will be out. There will be no gambling aboard ship between 8 and 9. You're all invited, and Hofer and Dyke are holding the meeting and using navigator material. So it just turned around. Then something else happened. 2 weeks later, captain said, I remember I was steering the ship when he said, told the executive officer, says, we'll have communion Sunday. Says, go get the wine and everything. So he came back, Wagner came back a little while later. We have no communion wine aboard ship. captain says, "That's funny. I signed for 8 gallons in Sydney, Australia, just 2 weeks ago when we were down there. You check again." He went and checked. Well, he says, I found, he came back about 20 minutes later. He says, "I found out that the chaplain and two Marines had drank all the communion wine." A week later, here another ship came up close. They put a boatswain chair, which on a rope over, and the chaplain was leaving, sent back to the United States. So we didn't have a chaplain a month later when the ship was torpedoed.
Well, that's a great story, and I'm impressed with the courage and the follow-through you showed there. I imagine that was a little intimidating situation there for a while, but it must have felt really good to see how it worked out.
Yeah, it was, but we knew who was in charge. Yeah, man, it was the good Lord was in charge. And this Herman Dyke was not a normal sailor. He would push, boy. He wouldn't take no for an answer. And so we just kept on with it. I don't know. It never bothered me when the sailors called me preachers and virgins and Bible thumpers and all. Didn't bother me a bit. But it was sure good in the water to know that they respected you then. And you're the same ones. And I had found in the Navy, usually the hardest guy was the first guy you could win. It seemed like the guy that wanted to take you out and get you drunk and tattooed and all that there was the first guy that would actually, when he changed, would really change. You know? The one that was really real to me when I was in the water was because I had seen, you know, when we got the first torpedo, there were probably 4,000 men in the water because Houston, there was 1,000. Canberra was another 1,200. There were two destroyers sunk then, and another one was the seagoing tug and that. So there could have been 3,000 to 4,000 guys in the water and that there. And here, 8 of us were picked up only out of that, all of those. And then the captain got out of there because that torpedo went out. So then later on the Kula Gulf, I started with another guy. We started the Navigator program on that. Of course, in those days, there's altogether different atom in the Navy. I'd say about 50% of the sailors at one time or other went to a Sunday school or something then. A lot of them came from the Midwest. And so it was just natural for them to be interested. And we had a lot of Catholics, sure, that were with us on that. Probably more Catholics than anything else that would study with us and that. And then one of the verses I learned, the whole chapter of Psalm 91, but it starts about in 7, 8, and 9, it says, 1,000 shall fall at thy side and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee, because thou hast made the Lord, even the Most High, thy habitation. I took that verse kind of as my own, and I had seen 1,000 guys in the water, you know, picked up by the Japanese, a lot of them, and different camps and that there. And here, 8 of us are picked up, kind of like a miracle, you know. Yeah.
Almost sounds like that verse was written with you in mind.
Yeah. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my God. Him will I trust.
While you're in the water, 14, 15, 16 hours, that's a long time to be in the water. During that time, did you ever fear that you wouldn't get picked up or that you might get picked up by the wrong side?
No, I don't know why. To this day, when I think back how I felt then, I always felt to be picked up by the U.S. I just had, maybe I was just too young to be scared. I just planned all night that the next day when got light, we could see what ships were around. And we didn't do it, but a lot of them, when they were in the water, and if they came over and strafed, then they would get under the water, in the water, until the plane went over and that. We never had to do any of that. Nobody strafed us or came after us. Of course, we were out there by ourselves. I couldn't see another sailor as far as you could look on the waves and that there when we got picked up. But there were 8 of us picked up, so that boat took about a half a mile round like that there, and the destroyer just kept going about 20 miles an hour so they wouldn't get torpedoed. And then the boat came close, and the ship never stopped. it kept going while the guys were getting us on, and then they got out of there. I never feared that we weren't going to get picked up in that. The big ships wouldn't stop for you. The battle wagons, cruisers, and them, they couldn't afford to stop. They had too many guys aboard ship, you know. And that's when you get torpedoed the easiest in that. So they would keep patrolling at 25 miles an hour. But then the small ships, destroyer escorts and them, the Phoenix was a cruiser that picked up about 25. And then when we came back to the States, there were about 100 of us on this old bucket, the SS Typhoon from Australia to Hawaii. But they had been picked up and other ships were coming in. So in San Francisco, we met. We had very few guys picked up by the Japanese from our ship because the battle was going and the Japanese couldn't spend time picking up people either. We went to Hawaii, and Hawaii gave us a month's survivor's leave at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel.
Tough assignment.
Yes, and they gave us surfboards to use, golfing clubs and all that for a month. I didn't know I was in the Navy then. The day after that month was over, we were in the Navy again, heading for the States. Then we got to Treasure Island, and for 3 weeks we were on there, and they were getting our written reports. And then I got another month's survivor's leave at home. Got to go fishing with some cousins and that. And then I went back. I was assigned to the Kula Gulf and had to go up to Bremerton, Washington, where I caught this ship here.
Well, you mentioned another month of survivor's leave at home. Did you tell your mother everything you'd been through? How did that go when you saw her again? And
no, well, just that we had been swimming. No, you didn't tell your mother very much at all because she wouldn't want you to go again, that's for sure. But she knew it was rough. We had a plan. My mother knew always where I was at. I had bought two maps when I was home, and I put numbers by 40 of those different spots throughout the world. Casablanca, a few over there, but most of them South Pacific, because I figured we'd be there. And so when I wrote her a letter, and maybe I'd write in there, oh, I saw the funniest thing. There was a guy that was 38 pounds, and that meant 38 what? Walking down the street, and he was a little pig man. He weighed only 38 pounds, but he was walking like a grown man. Well, she took that 38, went to the map. Oh, that's this island here. That's Guam. And so they knew where I was at by my letters and that. Of course, sometimes it took your letters 2 or 3 weeks to get home.
But you found a way to beat those censors who would have cut that information out if you had spelled it out.
In your letters, you know, there would be big black spots that they would just mark through because all your mail was censored by the officers, yeah.
So he had that code worked out with his family, and he also had some support from his family back home. When they finally reunited, he was asked what was happening 75 years ago this week. When he answered about those days on the calendar, he received a spine-tingling response about how his mother experienced those fateful days back home, having no way of knowing exactly where he was or what he was facing.
My mother couldn't sleep that night at home. So she thought, well, I'm in the most dangerous place there is. I'm the only one in the service. So she got up and prayed for me that night. My brother was going to Biola then in Los Angeles. He couldn't sleep either. And my brother did the same thing. He couldn't figure out why did he think about me so much then? Must be for prayer.
Just another wrinkle in the story Jonas Hofer told for decades at the typewriter and church supply store he operated in Dinuba, California, a story he continued to tell until his passing 2 years ago. He was proud of his cruiser, the USS Houston, and the men who kept it afloat, and he was thankful for that time and every time his life was spared.
Well, you know, when we look back, we see many points in our life, or turning points. One of my big ones was when I was in high school and broke my back. And one of the biggest mistakes I made then and what it cost me. And I like to tell my children and others in that there's sometimes very little things in your life that can really change it. That changed my life, where I had to be in bed there all year and thought I'd never walk again. But it got me back to my senses, and I'm thankful for that. It really made me think again of health, myself, and my good Lord. And that really did. That was a turning point in my life.
That was USS Houston survivor Jonas Hofer. You can link to his original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. There aren't too many left from that ship, but they are still holding reunions. In fact, they just had their latest one last month in Louisville, Kentucky, recalling again what happened 75 years ago this week off of Formosa. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.